You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Let's start with our motivation and thinking of the Buddha's great realizations. His omniscient mind, his having abandoned all the afflictive and cognitive obscurations, so that his mind is totally unobscured and can see all conventional and ultimate phenomena directly, and knows the proper way to guide sentient beings according to their diverse dispositions and tendencies and so on. So with appreciation, respect, devotion to the Buddha, then we want to emulate his great deeds and attain the same spiritual result as he attained. And the key to that is to having very firm determination to be free of psychic existence, the altruistic intention of bodhicitta that cherishes others more than self and wants to attain full awakening for their benefit, and of course the wisdom realizing the ultimate nature, which is what will actually liberate us. So we'll listen to teachings in order to learn how to generate all those qualities that are causes for the omniscient state of Buddhahood. And that's why we're here this evening. So we've been going through Nagarjuna's precious garland. Nagarjuna lived 2nd century. He was from South India and made his way up to North India. They say he was at Nalanda, but I'm not sure if Nalanda was founded in the 2nd century. Anyway, his teachings were certainly the root of the Nalanda tradition. And he wrote many texts. Some of them were praises, and some of them were collections of reasoning. And this one falls in the latter category. So this is Precious Garland, yeah, a teaching that he gave to a king who was his friend and benefactor. And so we're about three-fifths of the way done in the text. He started out explaining the causes for upper rebirth and for, you know, higher rebirth, and then the highest good of liberation and full awakening. And he also explained the two collections of merit and wisdom, which are the primary causes for attaining them. And in the present chapter, he's talking about royal policy. Yeah, in other words, how do you apply all this Dharma knowledge to your life as a leader, which is what the king is. Yeah, because if he just taught the king the Dharma and not how to apply it, then the king, his reign, his government, his laws may not be in accord with the Dharma. Because you know how it is, we have the intellectual knowledge of the Dharma, but when it comes to being practical, we're kind of out the window, off the wall somewhere. Yeah, so this chapter is quite beautiful. It's talking about how to be a leader and how to, you know, do things that get your populace to support you, get your populace to create virtue, how to create peace in the kingdom, You know, as we get on further in this chapter, he even talks about, you know, prison, the prison system and how to deal with criminals and all sorts of stuff. So the section that we've been talking about, yeah, was, it's called, Training in Vast Actions and Thoughts. That's the subsection of the fourth chapter that we're on right now. And so he's been advising the king to build monasteries and temples so that the populace can come and create merit and learn the Dharma. And by doing this, then, of course, the populace becomes more pacified. They also create better collective karma as a group, and that's going to bring much more peace and prosperity in the land. Okay, so last time we got up to verse 111. Okay, 311, sorry. Yeah, so I'll review 311 and then go on. So he says, you know, he's been advising to create all these monasteries and temples and so on. And now he said, it is preferable not to create Dharma foundations that do not inspire an opulent king, because even after you die, it will not be praised. In other words, if you are a cheapskate and you establish a Dharma foundation that, you know, leaves an opulent king rather flat, then, you know, you haven't put in enough energy to create a beautiful space that's large enough for a huge number of people to come and practice the Dharma. Okay, so he's also, Nagarjuna is also kind of baiting the king a little bit, saying that, you know, if you don't do this well, then you're going to be criticized now and after you die as well. So, you know, the king maybe has a little bit of the eight worldly concerns left in him, and, you know, he doesn't want to be criticized, and he also wants to please Nagarjuna, who's his teacher. Okay, so Nagarjuna is saying, if you don't do this, you're missing a great opportunity to create a lot of merit. Okay, and so he also says, if kings of equal or lower standing become famous through harmful actions, don't consider mimicking their harmful deeds in order to be famous. Okay, but if you want to be famous, then use your wealth to create Dharma institutions and make them so marvelous that the other kings around will go, wow, you know, look what this person did. Maybe I should do something like that too. Yeah, so a little bit maybe of useful competition between the kings. Or maybe you could call it inspiring competition to get other kings to think of using their wealth for the Dharma as well. Okay? And so he's also saying, okay, you do this, but you also have to be very careful not to be arrogant because you've built beautiful places. Yeah? And so don't think that it makes you famous and powerful, but rather think that, you know, may my deeds of building these monasteries and so on inspire other kings to, you know, build comparable places. And then also may it inspire the citizens of the country to come there and to practice and to create merit and so forth. So, you know, if he is telling the king, you know, to look out for his reputation, he's also saying, don't be arrogant when you do virtue. Okay, so he's being completely honest. And, you know, and I think this is quite important that, I remember many years ago I was talking with one Rinpoche I knew, and we'd known each other a long time, so we were friends. And even though I had a lot of respect for him, and he was all for building very big, you know, kind of beautiful monasteries. And I said, you know, why are we using the money for that? Shouldn't we use the money for the food and clothing to support the monastics? And shouldn't we, you know, also give something to society to help poor people and get them interested in Dharma, and just even so that they have enough to eat? And he was very firm about creating beautiful Dharma temples and monasteries, because he said, if they're beautiful, then people will want to come there. You know, if they're just kind of lackluster, which would satisfy me, then many people may not want to come there, and so then they would miss out on hearing the teachings and from creating merit by making offerings and so on. So it was interesting to hear his perspective, even though I didn't necessarily share it. I certainly don't want, you know, ugly monasteries. I think, like our chanting, our buildings should be an offering to the Buddha. But I don't think they need to be super opulent. And then also counseling the king, you know, don't get arrogant. And another factor here is don't try and control things just because you built them. Yeah, because it does happen in some temples and centers and monasteries. If there's one big benefactor, you know, then that benefactor often has a lot of say-so as to how the place is run. And that's not necessarily good for the monastic community, because the monastic community, you know, we have certain principles and ways of doing things and precepts, and so it's better if we're the ones who decide how our community works, what we spend money on, and so on. It was this kind of thing. Many monastics advised me about this in this way. So that you don't get somebody who's not living here, you know, feeling that they should have a lot of power and a lot of say-so because they were so generous in building the place. Yeah, you've got to really keep it a Dharma place. And also, I think, as you all know, I'm not in favor of giving special perks to wealthy people and ignoring everybody else who just gives a little. I think it's, we appreciate everybody who gives, and of course we appreciate people who give a lot, but we appreciate people who give $5 and $10 too, you know. I think that's quite important to have that kind of mind. Anyway, I go off on my tangents here. Okay, 3.12. With all your resources, you should make those, meaning temples and foundations and all, those that, for being so exalted, humble and encourage exalted kings and overwhelm inferior ones. Okay? So, again, this thing of use your resources so that you encourage the very powerful, wealthy kings, and you make the inferior kings think, oh, gee, I wish I could do something like that. Okay, questions about this? Is it clear? Yeah? Okay, so you should instead think, may my deeds inspire other kings to construct learning centers and benefit the Dharma. Okay, so like that. Okay, 3.13. Giving up all your possessions, powerless, you must go to the next life. But all that you use for the Dharma precedes you as constructive karma. Okay, so here he's talking about the benefits of generosity and the disadvantages of miserliness. And he's saying to the king, when you die, you have to give up all your possessions. You can't take anything with you. You're completely powerless when you die. You can't say, you know, wait, I'm the king who's dying. You know, listen to me, because it doesn't make any difference whether you're a king or a beggar or you know, who you are when you die. So you must go on to the next life. But all that you use for the Dharma, so all the generosity that you made for the Dharma, will precede you into the next life in the form of virtuous karma. Okay? And so through using your wealth in that way, then it creates the cause for a good rebirth. And when you have a good rebirth, also to have to have enough resources to be able to practice and be a benefit to people and so on. Okay, so he's really saying, look, don't be miserly, because you can't take anything with you. And if you use it for a good purpose, it will, you know, precede you in the sense that it will set up good conditions for you in your future rebirth. Okay. So he says, all of a king, of a previous king's possessions come under the control of his successor, so that the previous king, so for that previous king, what use will they be for Dharma, happiness, or fame? Okay? So when you die and you become the previous king, because there's going to be a new king, okay, all your wealth you can't take with you to the next life, but it's going to go to the next king, okay, and who will control it. And so at that time, you know, for the previous king, what use will the wealth be in terms of helping you create merit, in terms of giving you happiness, in terms of making you famous, in terms of advancing your Dharma practice? It's of no use at all, because it all stays here. Okay? And then to boot, the new king is going to take it and spend it on who knows what that you may agree with or not agree with. Yeah. So better to use it now when you have a clear mind, when you have power over these resources, and use it to create money and to benefit sentient beings. Okay? So he's really encouraging the king to be generous and not to be miserly, because, you know, miserliness is not going to help you at all. Okay. Then 314. Then 315. You receive pleasure in this life from enjoying your wealth. Pleasure in the next life comes from giving it away. What you have wasted by neither enjoying nor giving will lead only to suffering. How could it bring happiness? Okay, so if you have wealth and you use it in this lifetime for pleasure, you experience some pleasure, you know? You go on a cruise, you go on, you know, whatever it is that you want to do, a safari, or who knows what, yeah? A boat ride in, you know, Lake Erie, I don't know, a trip to Cleveland next week, you know? So, yeah, so, you know, you can use your wealth this life, and it brings you some kind of happiness. If you use your wealth to create good karma by helping sentient beings and advancing the Dharma, then you create lots of merit, and that will bring you much happiness in future lives. Okay. On the other hand, if you're very stingy and you just hoard all your stuff, you can't use it and you can't give it away, then it's, how are you? You're not deriving happiness from it this life or in future lives. And in fact, it's only become the cause of your suffering because you worry about it all the time. You know, are the interest rates going to go up? Are they going to go down? What about the stock market? It goes up, it goes down. You know, so all this attachment to present wealth, even though you don't use it even for the happiness of this life, let alone use it to create good karma for the future life. Okay? So all of us who cannot use our small containers, but we also can't give them away, you know? And all of us who have stuff in our drawers that we don't use, but we also can't give away. Yeah. I remember at DFF giving people the assignment to clean out like one closet or one set of drawers and give things away. And, you know, and then the next week they were going to share their experience. And some people just couldn't do it. Yeah, they didn't even open a closet or a drawer. Some people, one woman, it was so funny, she said, I started cleaning out my drawer, and I found this T-shirt from a trip I took to Mexico, you know, who knows how many years ago, that I even forgot I had. So if it had vanished before, I wouldn't even notice that it had vanished. But once I saw it, I remembered the trip to Mexico, and then I just could not bring myself to give that T-shirt away. Even though she hadn't worn it, and she even forgot that she had it. Okay? So this is the way we are sometimes, isn't it? You know, we hoard stuff with this mind of, you know, if I give it away, I'm going to need it. So, you know, if you ever need some extra toothbrushes, ask me. I know, but I'm changing. I'm now putting the new toothbrushes in the community thing. But, you know, there's certain things that we all may have that we kind of hoard, but we don't use them either. What do you have?
Writing pens.
Right. Pens. Pens, yeah. Oh, that's a good thing to hoard, because very often the ones here don't work. Yeah, they never work. So really, thank you. I should hoard this now. Then I'll stop all my frustration of coming in here and thinking the pen's actually going to work.
It's the old hoarded pens that don't work.
What else? Writing things?
Huh?
Toothpaste. Yeah. Hoarding toothpaste. Yeah, I have the brushes, you have the paste. We'll go well together. Yeah, but all different kinds of toothpaste. The one that's good for the Sensodyne, then the one that's good for sensitive gums, then the ones that whitens your teeth, and then the other one, they all the specialized kinds of toothpaste, you know, so that you have your variety of toothpaste to use whenever you need it. You know, five lifetimes worth of toothpaste.
No.
Oh, sorry, I exaggerated. Only two.
Well, it's those travel sizes, you know. You never know when you're going to have to get on a
plane. Yeah, that's true. You know, the small tubes of toothpaste. Because
right.
The big ones, they're...
They can't be.
Yeah, we have lots, but the small ones... Yeah, you're really going to need them because you got to get on a plane. And you can't even take the big ones anymore without checking your luggage. So you better have, you know, 2 or 3 or 10 small tubes. Because you can take 10 small tubes on. They won't bother you. But you cannot take one big tube. Yeah. Okay. So again, just reminding the king that generosity is the foundation of happiness in your future lives, whereas hoarding leads to misery this life as well as future lives. Yeah. So, you know, when we hoard, it's interesting because there's a mind of fear. Yeah, there's fear, there's anxiety. And I remember one time when I was in Israel, talking to some of my friends, and my friend's parents had to flee Europe right before the Nazis walked into their part, and they fled to South America, and then from South America they later went to Israel. And he was telling me that their freezer is always full, you know, because his parents, when they were escaping, had nothing. You know, so there's this fear of not having enough food. And so now, when they can afford it, the freezer, you know, is always full. So, yeah, we may have certain things like that too. But it's interesting how sometimes when you have enough, it becomes difficult to give because there's that fear of not having enough. But sometimes, what my experience living in India, you know, in some of the poor areas, is that the people who were poor, and like the very poor Tibetans, they were extremely generous, kind of as if you have nothing, so why not give it away? Yeah. Really, really remarkable. Okay, then 3:16. So he's really talking to the king here about impermanence and death. And he says, when dying, since you will lose your independence, you will be unable to give away your possessions. Through ministers who shamelessly cease to value you and seek the affection of the new king. Therefore, while healthy, quickly use all your resources to build Dharma sites, for you stand in the midst of death's causes like a lamp in the midst of a storm. Okay, so he's saying, when you're in the process of dying, you have lost your independence. Your body is too weak. Your mind is too confused. You cannot... You don't have dominion over your possessions or over the court anymore. You know, because when you're actively dying, I mean, you got to pay attention to what's happening to you right then and there. And it's very difficult because the mind is confused, because the physical elements are absorbing, the body is weak, difficult to speak. People don't listen to you anyway because you're dying. And so all he's saying, you know, look, all your court, all your ministers who are all so nice to you when you're alive because they want your favor, when you're dying, they're going to ignore you because they want to curry the favor of the new king. So they're not going to be around you. And even if you've given them instructions about how to... you know, how to use your wealth and things beforehand, they're not going to do it because they want to make a good impression on the new king. You're obsolete when you're dying, and after you're died, you know, forget it. Yeah? So he's saying that this is the situation, and so you've got to use your wealth now to create Dharma sites because you don't know when you're going to die. You know, you're standing in the midst of death causes because what is the cause of death? Birth. You know, we've had birth, death is coming. So we're in the midst of death causes. Like a lamp in the middle of a storm. How long is a lamp going to stay lit in the middle of a storm? Not so long. Okay. So he's saying to the king, you know, you may think, oh, I'm very healthy now, but when I get old, you know, when I'm on the brink of death, then I'll give all these things away. But right now, I want to hold on to them. And Nagarjuna is saying this is completely stupid way of thinking because you don't know when you're going to die. And when you're about to die, you don't have any control over that stuff. Yeah. So, you know, In terms of our situation, we can make out wills and things like that, but you never really know if your will is going to get carried out, do you? Yeah, you don't really know, because there's all sorts of legal maneuverings, all sorts of stuff that can go on, and you know, a lot of that can even start before you die. You know, because people are seeing that you're getting older. I mean, you read all the time in the paper about elderly people who are being cheated and deceived, you know, to change their wills, you know, elderly rich people, to change their wills and give their money to somebody else who just entered the picture. And if the person signs on it and it's the most recent will, then, you know, even if they're not thinking clearly, it'll go to court, and one person will say they knew what they were signing and another person will say they didn't know what they were signing. And it becomes a big battle for other people. And in the meantime, we never even used it to create merit. So what use is that? Yeah? It really doesn't make any sense. So, you know, to really use things now to create merit. It doesn't mean, you know, give everything away tomorrow, but it's like overcome the stinginess, overcome the mind of fear, and use the wealth that we have now to create the good karma that precedes us into the next lifetime. But at the same time, to keep our precepts well and to keep good ethical conduct, because otherwise we'll wind up like one of our cats who, you know, because of wealth has a very, you know, cushy life, but because of lack of ethical conduct is born in the lower realms. So we don't want that kind of rebirth either. Okay. Yeah. So it's also kind of saying to the king, you know, be careful of your ministers too. Yeah. Because whenever you're a powerful person, whenever you're a rich person, like it came up at the beginning of the chapter, people don't speak to you in a straightforward way. They're trying to get something out of you. And so, you know, what they say may sound nice, but they have an ulterior motivation. And you can really be manipulated and deceived by it. Okay? So he's also saying here, if you don't use your wealth and possession for Dharma practice, then at the time of death you'll be tortured by clinging and fear. Yeah, like what's going to happen to my wealth? Who's going to have it? Will the ministers do what I say? Won't they do what I say? I remember there was one woman, Tibetan woman I knew in Dharamsala, and when her father died, he had escaped from Tibet. She was just a child when they escaped. And on his deathbed, he was trying to tell her where he had buried some gold as he was escaping Tibet. And I thought, my goodness, you know, you're leaving this life and the most important thing on your mind is making sure that your family gets the gold that was buried all these years and never used and never told anybody where it is either for fear that they may take it. It's really kind of sad. So, you know, if you have fear and clinging at the time of death before, you know, while the senses are still operating, before you reach these subtle states of mind, then those kind of emotions that occur at that time are the ones that nourish the karma, nourish whatever karma is going to ripen. Yeah, so it's important at that time to have a virtuous state of mind. Yeah, after we get to like the stages of the white, red, and black near attainment and so on, then the mind is neutral and the karma is already in the process of ripening. Okay. Then 318. You should also preserve in the manner in which they have been established any other Dharma centers, temples, and such initiated by previous kings. Okay, so here he's saying maintain any previously established Dharma sites. So in addition to building new things, maintain the ones that previous kings and ministers or patrons or merchants or whoever it was built. In other words, don't waste their efforts in creating these places. Continue them on. Yeah. And I was always impressed with the Buddha when he, you know, because there were so many wanderers about who were, you know, gathering alms in the villages at his time. And he would make sure that if there were some people who previously supported another group but now became his disciples, he would tell them, keep on supporting in some way the previous people. You know, you don't have to give everything to us. And I thought, wow, that's really something, because even these other wanderers, you know, they're practicing a path that doesn't work. But the Buddha didn't want them to suffer by not having their benefactors anymore. I thought that was incredibly gracious of him. Yeah, because otherwise it's so tempting. Oh, you're following me now. Yes, you can give all your money to me. Don't follow those. Don't give any to those people anymore. Okay, but that's not the way the Buddha had his Sangha do that. Okay, then 319. They should be attended, okay? They should be attended by those who practice nonviolence, who are virtuous in conduct and keep their precepts, who are kind to guests, truthful and tolerant, who are not quarrelsome, and are always energetic. So here, you know, he just got done encouraging the king to build these places, and now he's talking about the kinds of people to have as administrators, as Dharma teachers, and so on. Okay? So here he's talking about administrators or managers. Okay? So they, in verse 319, means all these Dharma foundations, educational foundations, too. Okay? So they should be attended by those who practice nonviolence. Yeah, first condition. Yeah. There's not going to be violence, and these things are not going to in any way, shape, or form get used for any kind of violence in society. You know, either by selling the materials or by encouraging violence. You know, because if you have a manager in there who likes violence, they're going to encourage the people who come to be violent, and what's the use? That's completely antithetical to the Dharma. Okay, so your manager, somebody who practices nonviolence, yeah, they don't haul off and strike somebody, and they don't encourage their staff to strike anybody, or say that those people, you know, should be beaten up or whatever, okay? They are people who are virtuous in conduct and keep their precepts. Yeah, so they're people who, the people who manage these Dharma sites, yeah, they have to be virtuous, keeping their precepts. They don't lie, they don't cheat, especially if it's somebody who is going to manage the Sangha's property. They have to be extremely honest, otherwise they create incredible heavy negative karma by misusing the Sangha's property. Yeah. And similarly, if you have a manager or a leader who doesn't keep their precepts well, what's going to happen to everybody else who comes there or lives there? Yeah, if that person acts like that, then everybody else is going to think, well, precepts are a joke. I don't need to keep my precepts very well. Yeah. Look at the manager, look at the administrator. They're not doing it, so why should I? Okay, then these people also need to be kind to guests. Yeah, so when guests come, we welcome them. Yeah, invite, you know, give them something to eat or drink if they need, take them around, talk to them. Yeah, show them, you know, what kind of prayer book, you know, where's the prayer book, what page on the prayer book, you know, how to do prostrations, why we do prostrations, you know, which room something is in. So somebody who's kind to guests, somebody who's truthful, yeah, again, truthful, Nagarjuna is emphasizing that yet again, and tolerant, because when you have a temple or a Dharma center or whatever, you have all sorts of people coming. So you have to be very tolerant, very open-minded. You can't be like, well, only people of our social class can come, or only people who think like us can come, you know, because that's certainly not how the Buddha taught, okay? So being very tolerant, very open-minded, even to people who have big, large dogs, yeah, who bark. Even to, you know, we have, you know, her job is very interesting because she meets and hears from all kinds of people. And sometimes we have to confer because we get the applications from people that are unbelievable, you know. Like there was somebody who called once, I think he called or emailed, "I'm on the road from the East Coast, I'll arrive in 2 days and I want to be a monk." We never even knew who the guy was. Yeah. And I remember the first year or two when we had an open house, some man arrived with his bag, remember that? And he said, "I'm here to stay," and we're going, "Excuse us, you know, this is our home. People just can't move in." But you know, when you deal with these kinds of issues, you have to be very tolerant, very open-minded, very polite to these people, and not just, you know, act like a bouncer at a bar and, you know, throw them out. Yeah. You know, we had one other guy who arrived in the middle of the night and set up his tent across from my cabin, and he also wanted to move in, and he had bed bugs, and there was no way we could give him a bed in, you know, in any of our buildings because you have one person with bed bugs, and he knew nothing about the Dharma. He was basically looking for a place to live. Yeah. Yeah, we have all many interesting situations, don't we? Big dogs are the least of it.
They were just lunging at me. I invited them to come back.
And what?
I invited them to come back.
You invited them to come back? Good. Good. If you say this is the second time they've come and we still haven't been able to show them around, did you ask them to leave the dogs at home? She's speechless.
I was actually too afraid. Because the dogs were dragging them around.
You think the dogs speak English? Okay. So, yeah, so they have your managers, so forth, have to be kind to guests, truthful, tolerant, who are not quarrelsome. Yeah, because if you're in that position of greeting people, welcoming people, if you're quarrelsome, boy, you know, the people get a very bad impression of the whole institution. And always energetic. But this description here just isn't of our office manager. It's for all of us, how we should be, because we're all in that position of welcoming guests, okay, and of introducing people to the Dharma. And it's amazing how the first people somebody meets is, you know, is often what determines whether they come back for the Dharma or not. You know, if they meet somebody who can't give them the time of day, then they very often feel, well, you know, what's the use of Buddhism if it produces people like this? Yeah. Even though, you know, that person may normally be very friendly and they're having a bad day, still the other person doesn't know that. Okay. So he's saying to the king, you know, appoint suitable managers And he's saying to the managers, this is how you need to behave and how you need to think in your own heart and feel towards other people. Okay, so the managers need to be trustworthy. They need to be skilled and competent, so that they can get things done and so that the king can trust that they'll get done what they're supposed to get done. Yeah, because otherwise, if the king appoints people and then they don't do their job properly, then again, it's not good for the citizenry. Many people will suffer. Okay, so competent, energetic. Okay, then 320. The blind, sick, and downtrodden, the homeless, impoverished, and disabled should all without trouble equally obtain food and drink. Okay, so if you're serving the public, then everybody should get equal portions. Everybody should be served equally. It's not just when the rich people come, then you take them around and you offer them tea and lunch and you chat with them. But the poor people or blind or sick or whatever, you ignore. No, not at all. Okay, everybody is welcome and everybody gets food and drink equally. That doesn't necessarily mean you let everybody live there, okay? But when people come for the day, then everybody gets taken care of. They get shown around. They're respected as human beings just because they're human beings, not because they're wealthy or famous or, something like that, okay? So here you can see why the managers or why the people who greet the guests need to have to be tolerant, energetic, nonviolent, kind, because they need to overcome some of their fear of people who are blind or sick or downtrodden. Yeah? Because sometimes if you haven't been exposed to people like that before, when you see somebody who's very ill, yeah, or you see somebody who's quite impoverished, it's rather shocking, and 'cause people in our culture are very, very protected from things. Yeah, we don't see a lot of things in the world. And this is one thing I loved about the time I lived in India. You saw everything. It's was all there. You walk into the train station and life is happening. People die in the train station. So, and you see people who are ill and poor and who nobody takes care of. Some of them are deliberately disabled, so that they can be beggars. It's really a very sad situation. But anyway, you can see that if you're one of the people who are welcoming people to a temple or institution or foundation or whatever, we need to be friendly and open to everybody. Yeah, no matter what social class, no matter, what they look like or anything like that, okay? And share food and drink equally with all of them. I read an interesting article reminding me of sharing food and drink. There were four police officers who, I forget where it was, they went into a restaurant where they often eat and they were sitting there having lunch. This was just yesterday or the day before, something like that. And some other people walked in, and they didn't want to sit next to the police, to the cops. They asked to be seated in an entirely different part of the restaurant. Yeah? So they went to another part of the restaurant. So the cops were discussing it, and apparently they saw it as an opportunity to transform this into a good contact. So they paid for the food of those people. And when the waitress gave the other people their their check, it was written on, you know, this was paid for by the police officers that you didn't want to sit next to. And, you know, and it was paid for graciously, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, that's the way to do it. That's the way to change people's minds. Yeah. So that was off the topic, but I think it, not really. Yeah. It shows something here. Okay. Then 321, support in an appropriate manner those Dharma practitioners who do not seek aid, and even support those who are living in the kingdoms of others. So, you know, don't just support the king's citizenry. Don't just support the wealthy. Don't just support the blind, sick, downtrodden, homeless, impoverished, and disabled. Yeah. But also support people who aren't even asking anything from you. Yeah. Just people who are curious, or their neighbors, or whatever. Be friendly, you know. Give them something, support them. Because, you know, when they talk about the four activities to attract disciples, first one's generosity, isn't it? You know, I mean, that's exactly what these cops did. And, you know, it creates goodwill when you're generous to somebody. And they gave the waitress a $10 tip, too. Yeah? I thought that was very, very nice. Okay? So, and then even support the people living in others' kingdoms. So don't just have this territorial thing of, I'll only help my people because they're the people who I want to like me and follow me and, you know, they're citizens of my kingdom. But also give to people who are citizens of other kingdoms, other countries. Yeah? Help people who don't even ask you for anything. Yeah? So really encouraging, very wide generosity here. Yeah? So again, it doesn't mean giving everything away, but it means having a welcoming spirit. Yeah? Okay. And at the same time for us, with being Sangha, we also have to be very careful of what we share with guests, because it has to be stuff that the entire community has agreed to share. Otherwise, if we just take it and give it away, but the community hasn't agreed to share it, then we create the karma of stealing from the Sangha, which is very heavy negative karma. Yeah. So, you know, we all invite people to have, if we're having a meal, to join in the meal. We invite them, you know, to have a cup of tea, even if it isn't meal time. Yeah. But we don't go in the kitchen and get things that aren't put out and give them to our friends or to other people, because the community has not agreed on that. Okay. So it was very nice the way it happened the other day before going to the food bank. You know, she listed the things that we had excess of and then asked the whole community, do we agree to give this away? And we all said yes. So that's the way to do it. Okay. Then, okay, 322, for every Dharma site, appoint Dharma teachers who are energetic, free of greed, knowledgeable, pious, and who will not hinder those practicing there. Okay, so every Dharma site, you should have kind and wise religious leaders. Okay, so you not only construct magnificent places, but you need to have excellent teachers there who can teach and guide the people. Okay, so you want people who are not lazy, who are not easily distracted, who are very kind, who like to talk about the Dharma, because many of the guests and the people who come, they want to ask Dharma questions. They have personal problems sometimes. They want to talk to you about a personal problem, so you need to be able to talk to them about a personal problem. Or if you don't feel comfortable talking about that problem, referring it to another monastic to do so. Okay, so it needs to be somebody who enjoys being with people, enjoys teaching the Dharma. They should feel comfortable to help other people and give counseling, but without becoming emotionally involved in the lives and problems of the people who come. This is extremely important, and it's very easy for it to happen. You know, you make friends with lay people, or they come and they have problems and they tell you their problems, then you become Mr. or Ms. Fix-It, and you start thinking about their problem and what can I do to start to change their problem, and you give them advice, and then you say, well, I'll come over to your house and I'll help you, I'll do this and that for you to help you with your problem. This is not good, you know, we should not be doing that. We get emotionally attached to them. Oh, you know, they're having problems in their marriage, I really care about them, I want them to be happy. Or we develop some kind of emotional attachment relationship. Oh, they're my best friend. You know, I'm so close to this lay person, they're my really good friend, and I tell them all my problems now. And that's not right for a Sangha member. Yeah, as a Sangha member, we need to learn to handle our own emotional difficulties. And when we need help, we consult our teachers, we consult the Sangha. Yeah, when we have problems in a Sangha community, we don't tell them to the lay people or to a specific lay friend, because those people don't want to hear that. Yeah, they don't want to come up here where they're looking for spiritual information, inspiration, and hear, oh, I'm so mad at this other monastic because blah, blah, blah. You know, that's not being kind and considerate to the lay people. So we don't get emotionally close to them, and we don't talk about, you know, the private business of what's happening here, because they don't. And I've had lay people tell me directly they don't want to hear, because it harms their faith and it distracts them. Okay, so you know, we need to be the kind of people who can reach out and help, but you know, have our own emotional balance and not get overly involved in their relationships and worry about it, and, you know, and all kinds of things. Oh, I'm so worried about you. Please come stay at the monastery, this, that. You know, that's not wise. Okay? Yeah, Venerable Wu Yin talks about that a lot, because they don't have therapists and counselors much in Chinese cultures. And so the people come to the temples. So they come and they'll have marital problems, they'll have all sorts of problems. And, you know, and it's very tempting to get really involved, you know. Oh, let me talk to your husband and I'll see if I can, you know, calm him down, or, you know, these kinds of things. And she talks to her nuns very clearly about it, about not getting involved in this. You know, you counsel, you help people in a Dharma way, but you don't become Miss Fix-It. Okay? That doesn't help us, it doesn't help them. Okay? But we listen, we're compassionate. Yeah? But we have, you know, we have to remain emotionally centered ourselves.
Venerable, that last example, so sounds like skating awfully close to the song of Ocessa about not carrying messages between
men and women.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, I know the intent is more about romantic ones, but then you're triangulating it.
Yeah. In that situation, she said they're already together as a couple, so you're not initiating it. But she still says Sangha should not be involved. I mean, you give counseling to one party or the other, but you don't...
I'll go talk to them for you.
I'll go talk to them for you, or, you know, you come here and stay with us, or, you know... then such leaders also should be experts in acting according with the Dharma. Okay, so here the example is, if the Sangha is offered cattle or goats, this person knows how to skillfully care for the animals in accordance with the Dharma and should not harm or treat them roughly. So we don't get cattle and goats, we get cats. or it applies to anything, you know. If whatever people give us, we should know how to, care for the things so that they don't go to waste. It also says here that the leaders should not be disturbed by having to manage the offerings made to the Sangha. Okay? So the leader should be able to supervise and make sure things are used properly, but they shouldn't have to, you know, directly manage all the offerings and so on. You know, that's the job of somebody else. And His Holiness has talked about that in it for Dharma centers. He says the teachers should not be involved in like any of the financial things of the Dharma centers. They should just have to, they should just teach and, you know, not get involved in that kind of stuff. Okay, shall we pause and see if there's questions so far before going on to the next section?
Just a comment when you shared first, 18 about, continuing what the previous king has set up and thinking when I read that the Republicans in this country, if they would win
the election, they want to undo everything.
They want to undo, for example, Obamacare. Very sad because many people will suffer after that because millions of people, over 40 millions, I think, benefit from that.
And this is, one of the problems in the country right now is that the party that's not in power, their only purpose has become to say no to the power, to the party that is in power, instead of learning how to work together and compromise and do things that benefit the country. And it used to be the case that they could work together more, but now it's very polarized, and this is very bad for the whole country. Because then, whatever party's in power does something, then somebody else gets elected. They completely undo everything. They do something else. Then the other party gets elected. They undo that. They do something else. So nothing ever gets done. So it's quite sad, how we have one party that they say is now the party of no. And their Senate representative told them, the Senate, what was he? He's the Senate chief? What do you call him? Head of the Senate. Anyway, he told them the first day after the election, our job is to stop all of the president's policies.
They did quite well.
But it hasn't benefited the country at all. And that's not the role of an elected official, and that's certainly not the role of any of the people that Nagarjuna is talking about here. Unless, of course, the other party, had some kind of fascist policy, then yes, undo it. But otherwise try and build on good things.
Mm-hmm. Comment. Another reason why it's great to live in the monastic community is if you're on your own, I think it would be very easy to get involved in people's lives as a single monastic somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think that would be very, very challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as a single monastic living on your own. Yeah, then the lay people become your friends because you're not living with any monastics. So then you get very involved in their life. You know, take care of their kids, grandkids, you know, these are not things that we should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just cleaning up, my parents' whole many memories arise, and it's very difficult.
Is it start from the beginning?
Oh, so this person is cleaning up their parents'
it's home. Uh-huh.
Many memories arise. It's very difficult to give, throw away, recycle, and you can see they have a lot of attachment.
Yeah.
Meditate on impermanence. It helps some, but do you have other suggestions?
Meditate on impermanence more. Yeah. Meditate on death more. Yeah. If you're having a hard time cleaning out a house because you're finding all this memory, you're walking down memory lane and all your mementos and things like that, then you really have to think of your own death. And none of these things am I going to be able to take with me. And the next person who comes, who has to live in this place, or even if it's a relative who has to clean up when we die, if we saved all this stuff, they're going to look at it and say, what in the world is all this junk? Yeah?
I recommend they have a friend like Venerable Senpei come help them move. When I was leaving Seattle, she came over and I would kind of, to help one day, and I would sort of linger over something, she'd just say, toss it!
Just said, toss it. Yeah, Venerable Yeshe's good with that too.
Yeah. Another person who's not emotionally
involved. Yeah, another person who looks at your little mementos and said, what kind of is this? Yeah. Uh huh. Say that implementing some of these.
They try to do these that, what, you know, they have advisors that ask them to do these kind of things. But because of the lack of wisdom, you know, they're led in wrong ways.
Uh huh.
Yeah, so sometimes the intention in there, but they're seen as weak emperors.
Oh, okay. So so you're saying a weak emperor, and the ministers tell them to be generous. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. But you always have to, that's the whole thing of, yeah, learning how to, if you're a leader, learning how to discriminate who to trust, who's a good advisor, who's not a good advisor. Yeah. And also to have some kind of inner emotional strength so that people can't manipulate you by flattery or so on. Because some of these weak emperors, that's what happened, you know. They're so attached to people praising them that they'll make bad decisions to keep those people, you know, as their retinue or around them. Yeah. Now, whatever we do, we always need wisdom. Mm-hmm. So it's not being Mickey Mouse generous. Like I said, it's not just giving away all your wealth tomorrow and then you have to go, oh, I was generous for my next life. Now I have nothing. Can you give me some money? You know, that's not so smart. Yeah?
For verse 322, the copy I have here, where you said teachers, it says appoint officials.
Yeah, But the mean, I changed that because the meaning of the verse, you know, is teachers.
Okay. Yeah, and I changed it too, but it made me think about how, I think in Thailand they had a board that was, a government board that was controlling the monastics. Maybe they still do.
Yeah.
And how that can be so dangerous to have the government get in where they control things. And in verse 3:11, you touched on that, about benefactors not trying to control.
Yeah. Yeah, but also the government control. And the Buddha made it very clear he never wanted the government to control the Sangha. But you look, and in many cases, I mean, in Thailand, it's a big thing. The government does control the Sangha. Their initial motivation was to upgrade the standard of the Sangha's knowledge by creating levels of degrees and exams that people had to take so that they would have more knowledge and do things. But in the process of doing that, they kind of cut out the traditional role of the monastics in the villages, which often was to act as doctors and do things that chased away the ghosts that were afflicting people and, you know, this kind of thing. And now it's actually quite rigid, and you can see that in the issue regarding Bhikshuni ordination. You know, that that the Sangha, the male Sangha, does not want it. The secular government had passed a law in 1928 about making it illegal to ordain bhikkhunis. And so then the Sangha is supporting that law because it agrees with their ideas. So it gets complicated when the government is involved. Yeah. And it gets complicated too when you have a big ecclesiastical bureaucracy. You know, like what's happening in the Vatican, you know, very complicated in Thailand. You know, with the whole bureaucracy. On the other hand, you have the Tibetan situation where, you know, people think of His Holiness as a pope. He is not a pope. You know, he has no control over what people do. And, you know, people say yes to him and then they go do whatever they want. And there's very, you know, in many situations, there's very little he can do. And he said, you know, because sometimes if, let's say, some monks go out to a tree and they're not behaving properly, then His Holiness gets letters complaining about them. But he says, you know, if they don't listen to what I say when I give teachings, why are they going to listen to me now when they aren't following the teachings and they're in another country? Yeah? And there's no bureaucracy as such whereby he could, you know, kind of demote them or something like that. So, with bureaucracy there's problems, without bureaucracy there's problems. This is samsara. Yeah? So easier if we all have personal integrity and act properly and then save ourselves and others all sorts of headaches.
Find it difficult, like in China, Tibet, where monasteries are very close set up with government or permission, you know, like they are under the control of the government.
Government, yeah.
And then there might be a very serious teacher, abbess, who would like to spread the Dharma, but then they are kind of forced to work with them together and maybe also to pay extra taxes to make it possible. And so, yeah, what to do in such situations? At one hand, also, I have kind of recognized that it could have a very long-time effect. If you are getting too much involved in that, then you get superstitious, even to those who want to give you donation from the bottom of their heart without having any attention to that, besides being generous. You know, it can have a very big, deep impact.
Even having the government involved in the running of the monasteries.
yeah, that can have an impact if you let yourself be influenced by that. And then how you continue your work with two Dharma practitioners who just want to give generously. You are superstitious if they want to have, if they want to do something, influence you, control you, and
yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Suspicious.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, suspicious. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, so your warning, because I gave this warning against people manipulating you by being donors, and then you're saying you don't want to go to the other extreme and be suspicious of people who sincerely want to make a donation. That's very true. Yeah. And that's why we need to have our smarts around us, you know. And then your other point about like in Tibet and China, having the government control the monasteries, it's bad, you know. I mean, because they decide who can ordain, who can't ordain. They make the Sangha charge entry fees and sell tickets. You know, you have to sell tickets to go in to visit your monastery. And yeah, it's really kind of yucky. And then it's very easy to become corrupt too as a leader, because you want your monastery to flourish, but you have to negotiate with this government official who likes gifts. Yeah?
Traditionally, the religion and politics has been very close. Mm.
Exactly. And that's what happened in Sri Lanka. You know, they had three big monasteries, and then one of them got the ear of the ruler, and he told the monks and the other two, either you disrobe or you join this monastery. Yeah, and so it had a very dramatic effect on what was taught in Sri Lanka after that. Yeah, I mean, there's always these kinds of situations that come up, and they're quite difficult, you know. And, you know, having studied history myself, although I can't remember the details, I certainly remember that, you know, as you mentioned, religion and government was quite close. And it became a very, you know, corrupting situation in Europe, in Latin America. You know, I think it was very good what our founding people did, you know, by separating church and religion. I think it's very important that they're separate. Because otherwise you wind up with, and I think this is what the present Pope is trying to undo, is the church is preaching, you know, love and compassion and helping the poor and the needy. But the government doesn't want that to happen. They want to hang on to the resources themselves. And then the church has to comply to what the government wants. And yeah, it's very difficult. Okay. Is there anything else?
Yeah. I just thought it's really skillful how Nagarjuna is encouraging the king to build opulent Dharma centers. At first I thought maybe self-interested, but you know, you think of what kings spend money on, and they build opulent palaces or statue of themselves.
Yeah.
Taj Mahal.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's true. He's not just he is encouraging the king to, you know, use your money for the Dharma to enrich the culture and the education of the people, and you know, not build a statue of yourself or a summer palace, you know. And a winter palace and a spring palace and a palace, and you know, spend all your money on luxury items while people are undereducated and hungry.
Yeah. I also, on verse 320, there's just part of me that says in this country there was some way that we could reconfigure the money spent warring in the world to take care of all the blind, sick, and downtrodden.
Yeah.
We would have more than a money 10 times over to take care of every poor, disabled person in this country.
Yeah.
it's not from the lack of the resources, it's where we're putting it, in all the wrong places.
Right, right. It's not a lack of resources, we're using the resources to build armaments, which then get destroyed. So it's bad for the environment. But it's wonderful for the economy, because you build things that then get destroyed, so then you need to pay more people to build more armaments, you know?
And at the same time, you increase the blind, the sick, the downtrodden, the homeless, the impoverished, and the disabled by the use of your armaments.
Right, exactly. And that's what we see, you know, after, 15 years of war now. Okay. So then, okay, so we're stopping at 3:23. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting if you read these verses, you know. Policy experts who are pious, polite, pure, devoted, courageous, of good family, ethically outstanding, and grateful.
And hard to find.
And if you look at, you know, the lack of policy, you know, in the present election, we're not having a discussion of policy like we should be doing prior to an election. You know, we're having reality TV, aren't we?
Make America great again. Isn't that a policy?
Yeah.
What was the name of King to whom knowledge and all that?
It's in the preface of the book. Let me find it here. Yeah, there's some discussion about it. They're not completely sure. The king to whom Nagarjuna taught the precious garland is uncertain. Tibetans say it is King Udayibhadra. Udayibhadra? Yeah. Udayibhadra. Some scholars say King Udayibhadra was also known as King Gautamiputra Shatakarni. Gautamiputra Shatakarni. He was from the Shatavahana dynasty in Andhra Pradesh.
Okay.
Andhra Pradesh is where you're from. Okay. And some people say he was the following king, Vashishiputra Pulumayi. I don't know. Okay, that's the names that we have. But they sound familiar to you. Yeah?
So I was just curious, what did the king do after that?
Well, I hope he practices. I hope he follows Nagarjuna's advice. Check it out, and if you can find more information about the king and the dynasty, please tell us. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah, because we've never heard of the people before. We don't know anything about them, so it would be good for us to find out. Yeah.
I've been also wondering what the king did. There's a lot of, we focus on a lot of the negative things in society that are going on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that are doing on different scales, benevolent things. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this king did act on this, and if some of that is influence is still showing in societies today.
Yeah.
That those benevolent things that people are doing have somewhere.
Yeah, and they have affected some. Well, King Ashok in India, you know, his influence is still felt.
But even in our concepts of being benevolent in our society, so many years later, so far away, maybe somewhat of an influence from this direct teaching.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
This merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzing Gyatso Chenmerci, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravastiya in the west floor.